Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. And once again, we are back with the South American Files in the city, part three, section two, second leg. And we have arrived, having been in Peru for the last episode. We've now moved along. But before I let you know where we've gone to, let me introduce the usual suspects and the band that are all still together, despite the infighting and fractious nature that goes on between the episodes of podcasts and the preamble that we have before we start recording. We are still just about holding the band together. So first of all, I suppose the man whose band it is, the John Lennon of the foursome, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
I'll take that, mate. I've actually got a guitar up there. I can't play it, but I've got one, but you know, I use it for hitting people over the head with occasionally. Yeah, so we've definitely we've come down just a dub over 2,000 miles down to the sort of south of the continent. We've landed. The airport here has really got a great name. It's the Aeropuerto Internacional de Carrasco, General Cesario El Baviso. Don't know about that. It apparently was a pioneer of the aviation in the country where we are. The city was established in 1724 by a Spanish soldier, so many of them were. Bruno Mauricio de Zamayo. This city is often described, and I think I mentioned this in the last podcast, that it's contains more of the population of the country than the rest of the country combined. But apparently, according to the census in 2011, that wasn't true. It's got just over 1.3 million people at the time, which is about a third of the country's total population. It's the city where that hosted the 1930 World Cup, the first World Cup, first FIFA World Cup, and all the games in the World Cup were played in this one city. So although it's not the majority of people living in the city, it's still plenty of people. And there's plenty of football clubs for them to go to too, including two absolute behemoths of South American football that have won between them over 100 national championships. And we're in the Uruguayan capital of Montevideo today, mate.
I love that. I love the intro. My big fear is you guys putting the airport in your sat nav for the journey back. If that's the title of it, we could be there a while you guys are typing it in.
I copied and pasted. It might be okay.
Yeah, maybe that might be the way we do it. Okay, so Montevideo, excellent. Now to the Paul McCartney, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jim. I'll take Paul McCartney. I'm happy with that. You know, his peak years kind of like 67 to 70. You know, he kind of carried the Beatles over the last 3 years, really. So I'm going with that.
So you're just going to carry the last three episodes of the series, yeah?
Yeah, I can do that. Let John do all of the donkey work for the first decade, and then I'll just kind of like take all the glory for the last three years while he's occupied with Yoko.
Excellent. We'll keep a lookout for Gary and his loving with Yoko Ono. And then finally, we come to the understated brilliance of the band and the youngest member, the George Harrison, if you like, Mr. Pete Watson. Pete, welcome to the band.
Very kind of you. I was terrified about being Ringo for a moment, you know. I thought it was going to be that.
No,
I was worried it might have been Pete Best. You've gone for the replacement drummer line. So it could have gone lots of different ways. But yeah, no, I'll take George Harrison. Very happy with that. That's good. Yep.
That's okay. That just leaves me as Ringo Starr, who obviously was quoted as not even being the best drummer in the Beatles and just left to narrate Thomas the Tank Engine, which is pretty much where my podcast career will probably go after that, is an audio version of Thomas the Tank Engine. But in all seriousness, like Gary said, Montevideo, certainly a place that captures the hearts of the football romantics as the first place for that very first FIFA World Cup. Obviously, the clamour, certainly that I know comes from Stephen with regards to the centenary edition of the World Cup in 2030 and where that should be. And I'm pretty sure Stephen will shoehorn that in somewhere as a case for that World Cup tournament to be held in Uruguay. But as always, Pete, this is sort of your big moment. This is while your guitar gently weeps, here comes the sun and all of that. This is you just going through what is essentially a gargantuan hotbed of club football in one city.
I mean, you couldn't have put it much better than that. I mean, it basically, I mean, you kind of get the image of basically just landing at the airport and then just kind of like that Hackney Marshes picture of several hundred games of football, all with different clubs, their own stadiums. There is a lot of club. There are a lot of clubs in Montevideo. It is a proper footballing city. Just to give you an idea, in the first division, in the Primera División this year, there's only four clubs that aren't in Montevideo in the league. One of those, Boston River, actually was formed and did used to play in Montevideo before abandoning the city and moving to Trinidad. So you've got a whole load of other clubs there. In the second division, it's not much different. 10 of the 14 are from Montevideo. So basically, of the 30 clubs in the two professional leagues, you've got 22 clubs, not leaving much room for many of the others. The two behemoths that Gary talked about and that we'll probably spend most of the evening talking about today are Peñarol and Nacional. Two absolutely massive clubs, two of the greats of the continent in all ways, two of the most historic clubs. Two of the most, of the winningest clubs in the continent as well. We'll kind of come to them a lot more in the next kind of hour, I guess, or so. So let's talk a little bit about more of some of the also-rans that form the Uruguayan league. The old stages, which it's one of these clubs that are members of the club of pioneers. The first club in Uruguay are Albion. They are back. They were in the Premier League, the First Division, last year. Sadly, they got relegated, but they were founded in 1891. Disappeared for a long time until they, returned in 2017 to the professional leagues again. So it's great to have one of those founding figures back. It was long thought that because they were a club really of the English elites that they would know more. Much like Lima Cricket, actually, they're back and, with a vengeance. Two of the kind of the next biggest in Montevideo are Danubio and Defensor Sporting. They've both won the league four times. Danubio are quite an interesting story. They were founded by Bulgarian brothers called Mikhail and Ivan Lazarov, who had kind of emigrated over to Uruguay. They were named obviously after the Danube River. The club is very, very lucky not to be called Maritza. The Lazarov brothers' mother suggested that Maritza should have been the name of the club, but they thought it sounded a little bit feminine. So they went for Danubio instead. So there's a nice little story about them. The other club, Defensor Sporting, again, one of these old clubs. Again, it's won four times. They were originally formed out of a factory of glass workers. They're originally called Defensores de la Huelga, Defenders of the Strike, as in kind of not a strike as in goal strike, but striking as in, a workers' strike that's kind of very much a feature of 2023 Britain at the moment. They then actually merged with the Sporting Club Uruguay, who were much more known as a multi-club team. So to kind of build on the facilities and the reputation of the two of them, they've kind of created a new club. In order to kind of categorise a few of the others, let's do a few random colour stories of teams that play in certain colours. And we'll start with actually Defensor Sporting. They wear purple because it was the only colour shirts at the shop, Casa de Deportes de Freixul, that wasn't used by another club at the time. So there's one story. We also have a club called Bellavista. This was a club of the famous Julio Nasasi, one of the great kind of Uruguayan captains, and José Leandro Andrade, the great black player of the 1920s. They are known as the Papales, the Popists, or the Papists, because they play in white and yellow, which are the colours of the Vatican City flag. Although apparently the other story is that they chose one colour of Peñarol and one of Nacional in order not to seem like they were kind of favouring one or the other. Where's the other great colour story? This is Cerrito, a team that play at Parque Maracana, a slightly smaller Maracana than the famous one. But they play in yellow and green because originally the owner of the club, Esteban Marino, who owned a kind of material shop, discovered that yellow and green weren't being sold very well. So he basically flogged the yellow and green material off to the club. They made the shirts out of that and they've been wearing that ever since. So that's one of the lovely stories about Cerrito. Incidentally, there are various clubs called either Cerro or Cerrito. That basically means hill in Montevideo. And again, the Monte of Montevideo means mountain. But there isn't really a very big mountain or a particularly big hill in Montevideo. So it's a little bit of a full story there. Another kind of story about colours, we've got Phoenix, literally translated as Phoenix. They're currently a Division One club. They have a traditional fan shout, which is El Feni no Baja, the Phoenix don't go down. But they've actually been one of the yo-yo clubs of Division One. So that shout is more in hope than actual expectation or reality. They play in purple and white, which apparently rather grandly is supposed to represent eternity and purity. So there's a nice fact about them. And another little fact about quite a lot of the other little clubs that we have around Montevideo is that they seem to really have been founded in cafes. There's a huge amount of them that you go back in time were founded by friends who kind of met in a cafe, and that's where they kind of created their statements, they created their kind of membership, they appointed their chairman. One of those is La Luz, who are back in the first division this year. They're known as the Merengues de Aires Puros, the Merengues, i.e. like Real Madrid, of the Pure Airs, which is an area of Montevideo. And they were founded in the bar of Faustino Fernandez, which was one of the few bars that actually had electricity at the time, so they could go and meet there. Where else is there? We've got another club of a brewery following on from Sporting Cristal from last week. That's Racing. They were founded near the Colón Brewery, so they're known as the Brewers. And then another club is Club Atlético Cerro, not to be confused with Cerrito, who were founded in the Café Panizza. So that's a very, very brief roundup. We've not talked about Liverpool, but who would? I mean, they're the main Liverpool club, as we all know. We've not really talked about Montevideo Wanderers yet. Again, one of the great traditional clubs of Montevideo that we'll talk a little bit about when we come to identities. We've not talked about Rampla Juniors, who were famous for being the first ever Uruguayan club to beat an English club on English soil. But as it was Portsmouth, it's not really that big of an achievement, really. It's barely a club. We can obviously say as a Southampton fan. There are various others. We've got Rentistas. We've got the River Plate Uruguay. We've got the imaginatively named Uruguay Montevideo, who looked around and thought, what country in? What city are we in? And went for Uruguay Montevideo. We've also got the Man City kind of club, kind of feeder club, Montevideo City Talk. Again, one of these clubs that was created just because someone fancied having a going at winning something from scratch. And I've got one of the cafe clubs, Sudamerica. Again, following on from the Uruguay Montevideo school of naming clubs, they named it after the continent they were in, having realised that the city and the country had both gone. So they went with South America, Sudamerica, founded in a cafe, naturally. And finally, there are lots of other clubs, but I'm just going to give a mention to El Tanque Sisley, the Sisley Tank. I mean, there's a fantastic club if ever you've got one. I think we could all fall in love with them right there. So, yeah, we've got basic cafes, colours, and a few absolute beer moths. I mean, there's a few we haven't mentioned, but there's a bit of a starting point for us all.
Wow. Okay. Obviously, I've made a few notes. The main one being that although we're in Montevideo, and Pete, you've just rattled off probably the best part of about 30 clubs, you've still managed to slate Portsmouth and Liverpool, who were just innocent bystanders in that whole discussion and were minding their own business.
I am proud. I am very, very proud of Pete tonight. He's gone studs up.
He really has.
I approve.
Somebody's absolutely rattled George's case there, haven't they? They've really got it on him. Gary, we'll come to you. We'll come to you first with regards to sort of what Pete said. And I suppose, you know, the way Pete's sort of gone through it as brilliantly as he always does, I suppose it does just emphasise just how dominant this city is in what is essentially an entire nation's football program.
I mean, when I was doing my research, I found some of the clubs outside of Peñarol and Nacional, and I think that was a peak. Well, yeah, a couple. An interesting one, Uruguay Montevideo. I mean, this might be the only chance I ever get to correct Pete on a fact about South American football. They were actually named after two ships from the Uruguayan Navy, the two destroyers, the Uruguay and the Montevideo. So, yeah. But there were some really great names as well. And you can tell the old sort of British stuff. There's the Montevideo Cricket Club, who also played football. The Montevideo Rowing Club also played football. And they played the first football match, official football match, in Montevideo. And Montevideo, they played a team from Buenos Aires, so the first continental game from a team from Uruguay. But there's some great names of Pete says, you know, Club Alto Peru. I mean, I don't got another country's name in there. So I've done all the Uruguay, I've done South America. So borrow a name from another country as well. And the interesting one, as you know, Pete mentioned, is the Manchester City one. You know, apparently they ain't great. They ain't great. They got promoted to the first division for the first time in 2018. They did exist before City brought them. The club Atletico Torquay before City brought them. It just shows the sort of tentacles that these multi-club owners have across the world now. I mean, we've got one in Spain. They own Girona. And there's so many around the world. And Uruguay is not exempt. But, I mean, it's great. You know, as I say, I've found five clubs outside the big one, six clubs. Pete's just rattled double that number off as well. So, I mean, I thought there was a lot of clubs, but there's even more than I thought. There's twice as many as I thought.
Like I say, I think it's brilliant. And I think it's great that they've expanded that one club's Montevideo, one club's Uruguay, one club's South America, one club's going to be called Earth, one club's going to be called the Solar System, one's going to be called the Universe. And like when you're a kid, Stephen Gary's set you up an absolute tea with an absolute perler of a hospital ball if you want to go studs up on Man City. I know you like to have your say about the Oasis wannabes from the last episode. So if you want to pass comment on the Uruguayan equivalent of Man City trying to achieve success and heritage, please feel free to go right ahead. But be aware, Portsmouth and Liverpool have already switched off, to be fair. So we need to keep some listeners.
Well, City Talk, I mean, they sound like a really rank radio station, really. It's, I think when I came to look these up, they formed in 2010 or something like that. You know, I've got children that are older than that. You know, I've always taken the rise out of PSG because I've got a brother that's older than PSG. You know, it's, you know, turning around and saying I've got children that are older than City Talk, then, you know, they're just not worth it. But, just so many. I think this is probably the place that Montevideo's the, I don't know, it is the, I don't know, it's the full-on South American utopia of football. You've got, you know, the Estadio Centenario, yes, that should be the host venue of the 2030 World Cup final, but won't be because FIFA have no soul. If you look at, let's go back to, like, the Olympics, you know, the modern Olympics. 1896 to 1996, the centenary. Send it back to Athens. You know, do the right thing. Show soul. 100 years on, surely it's Atlanta. What the hell was that all about? You know, as an afterthought, send it to Athens. Kind of like 8 years beyond that. You know, there's no way in the world that FIFA are going to kind of like, you know, send the World Cup final in 2030 to the Estadio Centenario. It'll be in, you know, God knows where. It'll be in China. It'll be in Beijing, or it'll be in, you know, Riyadh or something like that. That's where it's going to go. No, it's not going to go to Montevideo. But this is the place, though. No, this is where you've got this, you know, magnificent national team that remain a contemporary thorn in the side of not only its, you know, South American contemporaries, but, you know, across the world, you know, for good and bad reasons. You know, they are, you know, we talk about the Dick Dastardly, you know, this is Dick Dastardly territory, but it's Dick Dastardly rolled up into one with, you know, the Hooded Claw. It's Sylvester Sneakley as well. You know, it's absolutely every Hanna-Barbera villain there has ever been, all rolled into one, but it's a beautiful thing as well. You've got these two massive clubs in Peñarol and Nacional. And then you've got kind of like, you know, at least 28 other, you know, littler clubs. You know, some of them not quite so little. Some of them that have, you know, had proud histories of their own and have achieved things. You know, it's the groundhopper's dream. You know, this is a place you could airdrop into and just spend a lifetime, you know, just watching and learning about football. You know, when you've got a city that has at least as many teams in one city, big city, but yeah, you know, one city that can boast, I don't know, a cluster of teams that amount to a third of the football league structure in the professional leagues of the English game. You know, Montevideo is the place to go.
If ever I set up a team in Montevideo, I think I will change my name to Sylvester Sneakley and become the chairman of that club. I think that is the pseudonym I would go under.
I mean, but Pete's come up with Lillers. I love the story of Lillers. It is to name themselves after basically electricity, because you know the bar that they were in the village was one of the only buildings in the village that had electricity. And it's like, what can we call them? Well, there's light here. We call ourselves the light. I don't know. It's a kind of frugal genius to it. I absolutely love it. I mean, there was another one as well, when I was looking up, called Salus, who were named after a bakery. You know, that's akin to us having an FC Greggs. It's just an absolutely magnificent thing. There needs to be an FC Greggs in the English pyramid.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Pete, you might not know the answer to this, and that's fine, but as we know, I just like to ask you stuff. In terms of, because there's such a saturation, clearly, of football in Montevideo, do you know or are you aware of whether other sports remotely exist and thrive, or are the other sports outside of Montevideo?
They are in Montevideo. If you look at the club structures, again, this is slightly more of a South American model, that a lot of the clubs start as sporting clubs more generally. So, you know, they do have basketball setups. They do have other kind of minor sports. You know, Gary's already mentioned that originally quite a few of the clubs were cricket clubs, you know, with the ones you mentioned, and again, Peñarol, as you know, probably know, was originally the west of Uruguay railway cricket club, Cork. You know, so I think the best example of the club that plays other sports is Defensor Sporting. Again, I haven't checked the basketball standings of Uruguay recently, but I think they're seen as the decanos, the kind of the leading exponents of basketball. The other sport that is pretty popular is actually rugby. You know, Uruguay have got to the World Cup on a couple of occasions. I think they're there this current year as well. I think Chile have got there as well, which is really exciting about. Actually, I used to coach rugby in Chile back in the day. Another one of the cricket clubs have played a national team for. Uruguay, again, is a bit of a kind of a rugby powerhouse, as much of a powerhouse you can be in South America. There was, I've forgotten his name. There was a Uruguayan prop who used to play at Bristol. Quite a few years ago, back on my PGC, who was a bit of a fan favourite. There are other sports. I mean, they certainly don't have the projection or the fame. I really don't know how many Olympic medals Uruguay has won in other sports. I suspect it's not very many. Actually, thinking about Bristol, there used to be another football club called Bristol. That was one of the founding teams of the Uruguayan league back in the day. And actually, another detail of more clubs named after English clubs is that the South America team, their first game was against Newcastle United. And Newcastle United 3-1, and that was pre-all the kind of Saudi money. So, although unfortunately, it wasn't actually the real Newcastle United, it was just one of these teams that, you know, had been inspired by Newcastle for some unknown reason. I think that one of the interesting things about sport in Uruguay, and potentially why it's got so much of a reputation, is that they really did make an effort to be modern, a lot earlier than a lot of the other South American countries did. And part of the reason for that is that they were kind of a buffer nation between Brazil and Argentina. They were created to be that. And of course, one of the major worries they had as a kind of very small buffer nation was the fear of being invaded by either, you know, Brazil or Argentina. So they were one of the first countries in South America to have a very strong program of building national parks parks in cities for the youth of Montevideo to go and play in. It was part of education from a very early era. I know that Colombia, particularly, there was an ambassador from Colombia who was really inspired by the Uruguayan example and went back to Colombia and started saying, we need to be doing these kind of sport programs for our youth as well. So there is a very long tradition of kind of at least sporting practice. It just tends to be kind of manifested more than anything else by football.
Great. Thank you for the answer, as always. Excellent. Obviously, Aidan's devastated and switched off now, as of Newcastle United. But that's okay. We're working our way through the Football League, so that's all right. In terms of then, Pete, back to, you know, sort of political affiliators, which is sort of the next thing we come to now, I guess. Once you have such a hotbed of football and so many clubs, I guess you've probably got every political and social leaning that you can possibly find. So, you know, obviously the two big clubs that we've talked about, Peñarol and Nacional, but I suppose, again, sort of those smaller clubs, those lesser clubs, and where they fit in the social landscape of not only the city, I suppose, but also the country.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to start back actually recommending a book here. A guy called Martin da Cruz published a book called From Beauty to Duty, which is a brilliant book. It came out late last year. It's available from Pitch Publishing. And it's about Uruguayan football from something like 1870-something through to 1917. And one of the best bits about this book is that it really gives you a great idea of where these clubs came from, why they were founded, what was going on socially, what was going on politically. And it really delves into Montevideo. He actually says it's a book about Uruguayan football history. It's not. It's about Montevideo football history. But that basically was football history of that point. But it is a brilliant book, and it talks a lot about the different identities and how the clubs were founded and who did it and what they represented at that particular time, where they emerged from. So I'd really urge people to after listening to this podcast, to go and have a look at it. But again, some of the identities that are involved. Peñarol, well, I mean, we've got Albion as the kind of the main club to start with. They were founded by British elites, and they didn't allow kind of other nationalities to join them. So then you get other clubs starting to schism off. But some of these football clubs to start with were linked to other British interests. So you have Cork, who would eventually become Peñarol, who is the club of the British Railroad Company. And there you get the starting point of some Uruguayans starting to play alongside people like John Harley, a famous Scot who came over and worked on the railways and was one of the great first advocates of the short passing game. He was a centre-half for Cork, then Peñarol, played for Uruguay as well. So you have this as a starting point, but then you start getting the Creole, the kind of native Uruguayan elites, who want to have their own clubs. And Nacional are very much the that's their identity. They're a club that are formed by university students of elite Uruguayan families, again, to play football against these British clubs, because there is kind of like a cultural wall between, you know, the British institutions like Cork and the kind of the Union and the Albion Cricket Club. So Nacional are founded with this idea in mind. And they're, again, very much linked to the flag colours of the Liberator, Gervasio Artigas, in blue, red and white. So that's their kind of identity, but that's kind of more of a slightly upper class identity. And then you get Montevideo Wanderers, again, one of the old classic clubs who a lot of them, their original members are part of the clubs we've already mentioned, but are kind of part of their little area and don't see their own, you know, their own rights or their chance to play or their kind of particular group being represented. So they split off and create their club. And they get known as the Bohemios for this slightly rebellious, the Bohemians for this slightly rebellious attitude. Another club that Martin talks about in his book is the original form of River Plate. Because there's another called River Plate who aren't the one that was originally formed. And they were kind of formed by much more of a cross section of Montevideo of society, of working class, plus some of the slightly middle or upper class. So they become one of the first expressions of a real diverse section of non-elite Uruguayan society. And the book is fascinating for this. It's got lots of different stories about how the clubs are founded and who these first people were that were there. In terms of some of the other clubs, one of the things I had a look at was actually looking at some of their Twitter handles and the identities in which they sell themselves. And I think what you probably mostly find is that a lot of them are based on the barrios. There is a lot of barrio identity. That's where they look to as being the centre point of what makes them important as their particular club. La Luz, for example, their kind of little, you know, quote on their Twitter thing is, "We are the barrio." That's their particular thing. We have Miramar Misiones, which is a second division club, who say we are the only professional team from our particular barrio. Again, you know, you have Rampla, again, who have their own particular identity that's linked to a particular street, and then they've got a rivalry because Cerro were there. Again, you have this kind of these barrio barrio rival identities. One club kind of moves to another one in order to find a pitch and find someone to play, and then a club is set up in order to rival that particular club that's joined them. So we have all these little things. A few of the other kind of really nice links to Barrios, we have Fenix, whose hashtag that they use is De Capurro Vengo, again, from Capurro I come, which again is another Barrio. So it's a very much a kind of, this is our Barrio, this is where we come from, this is who you support, in an attempt to kind of grab these kind of loyalties that otherwise would probably go to somewhere like Peñarol or Nacional. A couple of nice little other identities worth mentioning. The Racing Club, again, not the Argentinian version, but the Uruguay version, are known as the Little School. Again, is a club that is very well known for producing young players. Danubio have gone one stage further by calling themselves the University of Uruguayan Football. Again, for the similar reason is that they tend to bring these young players through, and we'll talk about some of those players later on. And the final club we mentioned, Liverpool, again, they've got a very nice little kind of saying, an identity thing, and their Twitter handle, and it is El Semillero de Virtudes, the seed ground of virtues, which again, I think is something that several other clubs could potentially learn from.
Okay. Gary, I'll sort of come to you, I'll come to you on this because I know, you know, how much, you know, how passionate you are and how you love to learn about the political association with clubs, you know, and their impact, that sort of thing. But to me, I suppose the thing that sort of shines through there more than anything else, and probably isn't quite so much what I was expecting, but looking back, it probably should have been what I was expecting. And it's more about almost a locality geographical affiliation rather than anything else. It's almost place before anything else. It's about the area and nothing else matters.
Yeah, it's a big thing. I mean, when you got sort of so many clubs in such a in one city, it's going to be sort of very precisely geographically defined. But when I was doing the research, I couldn't find, and I do look at that because I'm sort of interested in that, is political dimensions of clubs or influence on that, and it didn't seem to be that many. But the location thing is, I mean, just to give an example here, Torrevieja is a fairly, where I live, is a fairly sort of medium-sized town in Spain, and they had a club here, Club Deportivo Torrevieja, who actually went bust a couple of years ago and went out of business during the pandemic time, and they got started Phoenix Club from there, which is called Sporting Costa Blanca. Now, by definition, it's not called Deportivo Costa Blanca. It was very anglicised, and you can see why, but it hasn't got the following because it doesn't belong. It doesn't belong. When Club Deportivo Torrevieja was there, you could see quite a lot of people with their shirts on round. And we don't live too far away from Elche, you're a Primera División club, Valencia, Murcia are playing the Segunda. So there's been some big clubs around here. I mean, Club Deportivo Torrevieja played in the Tercera, so it's the third, which regionalised into about 17 different regions as well, so a really small scale. But when that went out of business, it lost the local ownership of the club for the fans. Not many people go and watch Sporting Costa Blanca, and the people that do tend to be English rather than people, indigenous population from Torrevieja. So, I mean, it just tells exactly what Pete says. Not understand the same sort of fixation for people and the club that they identify with, the barrio, the neighbourhood where they're located.
I mean, for you, you know, again, Stephen, you know, something we chat about quite often, but it seems probably here, and I assume it's purely through vast numbers and the number of teams that are there. But if you were to sort of lay out, you know, sort of a bird's eye view almost of social standing and the social microcosm that is Montevideo, it's absolutely reflected right back at you through the football.
Oh, completely. I mean, I think probably more so with Montevideo because you've got such a broad spectrum of teams to be able to be drawn to. Yet, you know, so much of the nation is drawn towards this blinding light of Peñarol and Nacional. And, you know, it will be, you know, a lot of that traditionally will have been down to status, and, you know, as it forever is. You know, it dilutes over generations because it tends to be something that is handed down, certainly for the oldest clubs and then traditional clubs. I mean, it's a bit different in some of the other podcasts that we've touched upon when we've been talking about kind of like relatively recently formed clubs sometimes, you know, that have been, I mean, I'd say in the 1950s and so on and so forth. But when we're talking about, I mean, this is where kind of like football really kind of like took hold very, very early in South America, in South American terms. So, you know, there's almost like a Europeanized part of the outlook and the system, you know, as far as Montevideo is concerned. Yet, you know, it doesn't have as much of the volatility as a lot of other, you know, cities do across South America. You see, what I found quite interesting was that when I was looking at the vast array of clubs, is that there's very few that, you know, appear in 1919 and vanish by 1923, for instance. You know, that we often see in other, you know, in other episodes of this podcast. You know, these have all been kind of like predominantly clubs built to last. But you do get that dilution because, you know, obviously family fortunes change over periods of time, yet a family's football club doesn't. That tends to last as a thread through, you know, a family. So you can have a family that are well-to-do in the 1920s, yet, you know, the completely working class 100 years later, yet they're still supporting that football club, you know, and it doesn't matter whether they're seen as kind of like the socially mobile football club or the one that is for the working classes. You know, it becomes less of a, you know, less of an importance.
I'm just going to add to another possible reason why there aren't as many politically linkages with, you know, with some of the Uruguayan clubs, is that a lot of the clubs are started by young people. These are young people that don't really have any particular or as much of a political awareness at the time that the club is founded. So there isn't particularly a founding narrative of, you know, potentially a club that has been built by, you know, workers as much. I mean, there are examples of that, but not particularly as many as, for example, somewhere like, you know, Chile, for example, which has a very strong working, you know, factory club tradition in Santiago. There's a brilliant book by Brenda Elsie that talks about that. So that's one aspect that potentially, you know, leads to the lack of politicization of the clubs at an early level. I think another facet of it is that there's quite a strong division, or there was particularly at the time where a lot of the clubs were founded, and very much two political main parties and quite a binary opposition between them, the Colorados and the Blancos. And then being quite a tradition of civil wars. And I kind of wonder whether, and this is very much, a speculation much as anything else. And I'm sure that there are some of the academics like Andres Morales and people like that who can talk about it more. But I wonder if that politicization meant that people actively didn't look to create other associations that were built on a political format in their leisure time. I wonder whether something that brought them together on more of a playing field was a place where those political affiliations that had been so harmful in the 19th century could be a little bit left behind, particularly when, you know, you have a period where, you know, presidencies of Varela and various others are actually starting to, you know, create a sense of progression and create a sense of progress. I think, I mean, really, if you look back at Martin da Cruz's book, one of the few clubs he does associate with slightly more of a political dimension is River Plate, the original River Plate of Uruguay, who have, I think, some anarchists or people with anarchist tendencies who are part of the formation of that club, and I think are involved with, you know, fairly radical newspapers at the time as well. But yeah, I mean, that's speculation rather than any kind of, you know, grounded in fact theory. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what you're not seeing, though, I mean, we've looked at other cities and it's kind of like there'll be a defined industrial team. There'll be, you know, a team made up of the rail workers. What this is striking me as is it's very much a case of it's football as a leisure pursuit. You know, it really is what it was built to be. You know, it's, as Pete said, you know, a lot of the stories behind the formations of the club are young people coming together, you know, who have probably not been, I don't know, sullied by a working life really as such. You know, they haven't been drawn into those divisions and unions and all of that creates the schisms. These are people that have come together probably from many walks of life. You know, to just, you know, form a football club simply because that's what they wanted to do.
I mean, Kurka, the one exact, you know, Peñarol's four players are one of the few different ones, but that's owned by the British. And then there is very much a schism of, you know, the railway club, the then kind of manager, I think his name's Edward Bass from memory. But he doesn't want to have anything to do with the football sections. So that's part of the reason why, you know, Peñarol eventually disaffiliate from the railways and become their own association. So again, like Stevie said, you know, they lose that kind of working factory railway type identity and become more of a club of football first and foremost. And they might, a few of them might still work on the railways, but that's not their their main identity potentially.
I love to romanticise it as cafe culture and that idea of going with your friends for coffee and forming a football team, which is clearly a life goal of mine that I would like to do. And that's how I like to romanticise the sort of finding of clubs or the founding of clubs in Montevideo. In terms of this very, I suppose, beautiful aesthetic picture that you're painting here, Pete, which is very unlike the football that we associate with Uruguayan football, but I'm going with it. The domestic, and for me, what I find the most interesting, the continental success and performance of clubs from the particular city, and obviously in this case Montevideo, and I guess this is where the big two really do come to the fore in this discussion.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. I mean, as Gary already mentioned, the two clubs have won over 100 titles between them. Peñarol are slightly ahead with just over 50, ahead on in the race against Nacional at the moment. But they absolutely dominate the trophies. And again, it's quite similar in South America. You know, these are the two clubs have had a real continental impact, which the Peruvian clubs we talked about last week, haven't achieved. And Peñarol really, in lots of ways, you could see them as being, the first great South American trophy winners. You know, they win the Libertadores in 1960 and 1961. You know, they've won it three times since. It should be said they were runners-up in 62 as well, and again in 65. So, in that first decade of the Copa Libertadores in its early stages, they are one of the great teams. And you've got the great Alberto Spencer, the Ecuadorian forward, to be grateful as part of that. Nacional are slightly further behind. Their first Libertadores isn't until 1971, but they win it on two more occasions, 1980 and 1988. Runners up on three occasions. So, Peñarol are ahead of them. I think one of the interesting things here is that there's been a real comparative lack of success really since the end of the 1980s. It's worth saying actually that Danubio are the semi-finalists of the Libertadores in 1989. And then ran into Atletico Nacional of Pablo Escobar, and it was a mysteriously high score in Atletico Nacional's home leg. So, Danubio, I'm sure, will still be pointing to the injustices of refereeing and drug cartels as why they didn't get to play their Copa Libertadores final in 1989, and Atletico Nacional did. So, and that was actually a particular time when Danubio were a good club. They had some really good players. Uruguayan clubs haven't really had that success since. Defensor Sporting, the kind of the other potentially big third club, got to the semi-finals in 2014, which is a good achievement. But there is a bit of a black hole in success, really, since the kind of late, the light 1980s. And one of the weird things, which sounds really weird, is that in the Copa Sudamericana, the effectively the UEFA club, no Uruguayan team has actually ever got to the final, which is staggering, really. I mean, the only two other nations that haven't managed that in South America are Venezuela, no surprise there, and Paraguay, which is slightly more of a surprise. But every other country has managed to get a team to the final one point or another, even Bolivia. So that kind of indicates a little bit where maybe Uruguayan club football really has been, is that there is a slightly, I guess, harking back to former glories, and it hasn't really... hasn't really coped with that kind of transition to the era in which a lot of players are moving to Europe at an early age. I think the other thing that's really nice, going back to Twitter accounts and ways in which clubs state their pride, is that a lot of the clubs that have won the league once or did well once in Libertadores, that's their kind of one of their major features on their Twitter handle. I mean, for example, Rampla Juniors, conquerors of Portsmouth. They won the league in 1927, the one time they did it, and that's there proudly in their kind of Twitter handle. Bella Vista won the league once in 1990. Central Espanyol, team we haven't mentioned, won it in 1984. Progreso won it in 89. Even Liverpool have won a couple of intermedios, the kind of halfway cups here and there as well. And these are really proud events. What I love about it is that you have these amazing stories that are part of the web pages of these clubs like Cerro, like Liverpool, like Danubio, like Montevideo Wanderers. And it's the story of our Libertadores run where we played against Independiente, we played against a Brazilian club and we got knocked out in the second round. But that's the one time we made it. And that's where all our fans were there. We all remember it. We all went to the game. And And I love that. That feels like a really great thing that these, you know, that these kind of a lot of the times very second or third rate clubs have got that one trip into the Libertadores, and that's the kind of the source of their pride in the stories that, you know, that they, the fathers tell sons about, you know, we were there when we got beat by Racing or whatever it might have been. So yeah, that's nice to see.
And what you had, what, sort of just jump in there, is what you had as well, is despite this, you know, Peñarol Nacional hegemony over these, you know, to share 100 league titles, and even then Peñarol have managed to throw three of them away because of the behaviour of the fans, basically. You know, so it would have been more. But like between, you know, Pete mentioned, you know, Central Espanyol winning it in 84 out of absolutely nowhere. They'd only won promotion the year before. But then there was like this little spike of between 87 and 91 where Defensa win a couple, Danubio and Progreso win. You know, it's kind of like this you know, brilliant little oasis at the end of the 1980s. Yet at a time when Peñarol still lifted Libertadores in, what, 87 and Nacional in 88. So it's kind of like, you know, the big two have focused on winning that Libertadores, and then others have just flooded through domestically. So it's kind of like, you know, it was a, you know, an interesting era. But then for them not to add any more Libertadores since then is one of the great anomalies. I mean, we've even had like an Ecuadorian winner of the Libertadores since then, you know, a couple of Colombians, a Paraguayan. You know, so yeah, you know, there's Brazil and Argentina have dominated, and currently, you know, they own it. But like this is like the big anomaly is that Uruguay, who are, you know, clearly, you know, number three in this little kind of like triangle of you know, nations that at the top end of South American football, not to have added one, never to have won a you know, Sudamericana. Is such a strange phenomenon.
But is that why we love it? Like,
is it? Oh, totally. Yeah, completely.
Gary, something that struck me that what Pete was saying then is partly probably because I don't overly support a team and Hull City are my nearest team, as we know. But that owning of minor success is probably one of the best things that I've heard, that teams put in their Twitter bio which round potentially that they were knocked out of the Copa Libertadores. For me, I think that is brilliant. I think it's great that clubs, and it's absolutely how it should be. You know, you could get laughed at by fans from bigger clubs, or it could be dismissed as why would you put that, you know, in terms of mentality. But for me, but for clubs to own that level of success, and as Pete said as well, that, you know, telling your children that you were there at that game, or you were there when you got through the first round but they were not tied in the second round, stuff like that, to me is absolutely what football still should be about.
Yeah, it's a nicely made point, Stu. I guess, you know, I'm always saying about sort of football clubs, and whether it's a club who's going to win the league title or somebody, a club's going to win the fourth division of the Evo Stick League. Success is success. A triumph is a triumph. And, you know, it means no less, or it should mean no less to a fan of a club that wins the Evo Stick League. And if it only happens once, it's even more special. I know it sounds crazy to say, but if it becomes the norm, you know, each progressive title that you win, you know, if you win the league title, let's say when Juve won it, 9 times the bounce, Serie A, it became less special almost every time because another one. Oh, there you go. So I think the clubs that have won, you know, a big trophy once, it's a different magnitude of joy of acclaim that they've earned. So yeah, why shouldn't they brag about it? I think they absolutely should.
I love it. I think it's brilliant, and long may it continue. With regards to the big games, Pete, which is the next thing we come to look at. And I like it when you guys talk about particular famous games, which is probably a little bit more interesting. But what are the Peñarol Nacional games like? Because, I mean, they must be the ultimate in Uruguayan domestic football. And it's 2 a year and that's it. You know, it's...
Yeah, it's gigantic. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's without question, you know, one of the probably the top five, you know, city derbies in the world, without question. It's absolute. It's colourful, it's vibrant, it's, you know, verges on the edge of danger. Martin da Cruz in his book, you know, shows how a lot of the very early derbies were marred by crowd violence and protests and anger and fans getting het up with each other. So, you know, it's been a very long tradition of rivalry, of it being meaningful. And, you know, and again, it did have that start. It's kind of shifted from, you know, having that, you know, the Creoles and national players against the English players, the clubs of a different country. It started there, and then it becomes increasingly about national pride or about city pride or about classes, because Peñarol get associated with being, you know, the working class team for a little bit, you know, because Nacional, the team of the elites. So it has every kind of component of history. I think they've played some like over 500 games against each other. And it is absolutely phenomenal. I mean, there's an absolutely brilliant Peñarol documentary called Manias, which is one of the names of the kind of Peñarol fans are called by. It originally meant shit eaters, actually. Manja mierda. So it comes from there. There's a story about that in the Martin da Cruz book as well. And they kind of owned it. Which again is another Latin American football club tradition. Earn your insult, and it becomes a mark of pride. But there's a brilliant documentary that goes into, you know, the fan culture, what goes into the games, what goes into the experience, the day. You know, the country kind of comes to a halt. You know, in that particular documentary, they get former presidents, they get famous Uruguayans talking about what it means, and it is a national event. You know, this is basically the country kind of stops, the city stops, and, you know, they wait with bated breath to see what happens in the derby match. And it is a proper, you know, football game in terms of football, you know, commentators using the word proper to be loaded with every bit of properness that possibly could be. It is the most proper of all of them.
Good. That's exactly how I wanted it to be. And I love the quote that you put it in the top five big city derbies in the world. I'm all about that. Big games then, guys. So hopefully you've done your research and you've either come up with the most random game from the 1920s or you've come up with things where there's been subterfuge and dastardly deeds or whatever it is, but hopefully three games to entertain us and certainly people who are listening to go and find out more about. Gary, I think we'll start with you first, your choice of game.
Well, you know what I do, Stu, you asked me to choose one thing.
You picked two, aren't you?
There are actually, I'm going to talk about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 games.
And you've just taken it to a whole new level.
We're going back to 1962. You mentioned that Peñarol and Nacional only played each other twice. And that year, they played each other at least five times. Basically, in 1916-61, Peñarol had won the Copa Libertadores. They beat Olimpia of Paraguay in 60. The great man Spencer scored in that game. And he was top scorer that season for the Copa Libertadores. I think he's still... the top goal scorer in the Libertadores. This is, you know, this is against Pele. I mean, you can't say Maradona because he obviously played in Europe a lot, but Pele played all his time in for Santos until he disappeared to America in the last few years. But so anyway, they won it in 60, beat Olimpia of Paraguay. They won it in 61, beating Palmeiras. So they qualified for the 62 tournament as holders. Nacional won the league. So he had two Montevideo teams in the competition. And as luck would have it, of course, they played each other in the semi-finals. Now, it's a strange situation, the Copa Libertadores, because it doesn't go on goal difference over two legs. It's a win. And if they both win the game, they play the playoff. And only after the playoff, even if that's a draw, does goal difference come into account. So in 1962, Peñarol, all the games are played at the Estadio Centenario in Montevideo, and then Nacional won the first leg 2-1. Peñarol won the second one 3-1. So you think, okay, they should go through, but they didn't. So they had to play a playoff game. This is all in the space of a couple of weeks. They played Peñarol played Nacional again in a playoff and drew 1-1. And only after that did Peñarol qualify because they'd scored more goals. I mean, a crazy situation, really. But anyway, so Peñarol go into the final and they play, ironically, Santos. Peñarol lost at home in the first leg, lost 2-1. Spencer scored their goal, but put them ahead, Coutinho scored twice for Santos. So they go to play Santos in the second leg, And all Santos need is a draw, basically. But Peñarol won. Spencer scored a brace, of course, because he blooming does. And they won 3-2. They're again in a sort of situation where you think, okay, are they going to win a goal difference? But no, you have to go to a playoff. So they played a playoff game to decide the Copa Libertadores. And Pelé hadn't played in the first two games. He came back and played in the playoff game, though, and scored twice, and they won 3-0. So Peñarol got through the semi-final after a playoff against Nacional, but actually lost the final after a playoff against Santos, even though they had scored. They should have got through on goal difference, logic would suggest, on aggregate. Just crazy sort of run of games, but obviously the conflict between Nacional and Peñarol sort of fed into that as well. So there you go, seven games, but seven for the price of one.
I can't believe you, and it worked. That whole context was needed for that story, but you actually took the liberty of seven games when it was just one. But well done, Gary. Well explained. And again, certainly things for people to look into in terms of research. And obviously, I suppose that just highlights the influence of Pelé, I suppose, when they've taken all those games to try and get to the final and win it, and then Pelé rocks up in one game and wins it.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the story. Yeah. Stephen, we'll come to you next for your, well, I say one game. You might as well just pick a whole season if you want. That's gone out the window. So just pick as many as you want. It doesn't matter anymore.
So this is like naming the team after kind of like the city and then the universe.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's it.
Bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah. I'm going to go for the beaten track. You know, Peñarol and Nacional have had the, you know, enough of the limelight. I'm going for 2009. I'm going for April. Basanas took on Albion and stuff them 15-0. Absolutely stuff them 15-0. I mean, we talk about Albion coming back to the top flight, you know, 2021, 2022. 113-year absence from the top division. You know, I doubt there's a bigger exile of a team that have, you know, dropped out of a top flight somewhere and then returned. You know, there'll be plenty of teams who've played early on, dropped out, never returned. But that, you know, but to go away for 113 years and then come back, but to have kind of come back from this low, this epic low of not, well, what we're talking, kind of like a, not much more than a decade earlier, just over a decade, to, you know, decade and a quarter maybe, you know, to 15-0. You know, this was, you know, an incredible piece of football where, you know, Two highly popular football clubs. And then that's the great thing about Montevideo, is the more that you read into the teams as well, the more popular the small ones are, because they're just so niche and likeable. You know, what you know, there seems to be very little in the way of antagonism between these clubs as well. There seems to be a really good kind of like comradeship, you know, amongst the teams that are further down the pecking order, as if they've kind of like saying, well, look, you know, Nacional and Peñarol have it all their own way for the vast majority of the time, but we're not going to be bitter and twisted about that. We're just going to have our own fun. Yeah. So yeah, I'm going for Albion's turnaround from 113 year, you know, exile via a 15-0 drubbing at the hands of Basanas.
That's niche. That's incredibly niche. However, if the entire game is available to watch as a bit of quick maths, it's a goal every 6 minutes. So there's plenty to keep you occupied should you find it. Okay, so clearly numbers is the way to go here, Pete. We've had seven games. We've had 15-0. Which is your game of choice, whatever you have? Look, what we
okay,
call it.
Well, I'm going to involve a couple of derby matches of the classic, but they're going to involve numbers and their name. So I'm going to stay on that theme. I'm not going to talk about the classic of the 8 against 11 when Peñarol had three players sent off and still won. I'm not going to talk about the classic of the escape when Peñarol were winning 2-0 at halftime in 1949 and Nacional headed off because they're angry with the ref. What I'm going to talk about, if you cast your minds back to 1933...
A kind of escape to defeat that one rather than escape to defeat
that
one.
Yeah, one of those, yeah.
I read into that one. That was on my shortlist as well, until I saw 15-0. Yeah.
So we're going to go with the Clásico de la Valija, which effectively translates as the classic of, I guess, the briefcase, the classic of the briefcase. So what happens here is that this is a crucial derby to win the league. It's Peñarol against Nacional. It's quite early in the game. And the Brazilian Peñarol forward, Bahia, takes a shot and it just trickles slightly wide of the post. But it hits the bag of the Nacional physio, Juan Kirschberg, rebounds into play and is slammed into the net by Braulio Costa, who in true, you know, South American fashion runs off claiming the goal. And the referee, who's got a brilliant name, I've never known anyone called Telesforo before, but Telesforo Rodriguez, gives the goal. And of course, you can imagine this kind of, you know, leads to an explosion of anger from the Nacional lads. José Nassassi, the great captain of the 1930 team, is sent off. Juan Labraga is sent off, as is Ulises Chiflet. And the game is called off as Telesforo Rodriguez heads for the changing room and refuses to come out. It takes quite a while for this game to actually be replayed. In the meantime, Nassassi is given a year ban. Labraga is given a 15-month ban. Chiflet apparently didn't do quite as bad, and he's allowed to play again. But the game restarts in August, some few, I think it's 3 months after the game was supposed to finish. This derby has a name. So the original, the derby of the briefcase, has now become the diary of the 9 versus 11, because Peñarol take a 2-0 lead. But then Hector Manco Castro, who is, you know, who's a player whose arm has been cut off in an accident when he was young, scores a hat-trick for Nacional in the second half to win it 3-2. So that's probably one of the great derbies. And I'm going to mention two big games for both clubs where they both won something, just to kind of keep on the right side. And it's a story that pains me a great deal. The 1987 Libertadores Cup win for Peñarol against América, my Colombian club. In the dying seconds, Colombia, you know, America, who lost the Libertadores finals in 85 and 86, are seconds away from winning it. It's the third game of the playoff, like Gary was saying. If they draw it, it's going to be an America win on goals scored. And Diego Aguirre manages to score in basically the final seconds of extra time to win the cup for Peñarol. And it destroys the Americans. They'll collapse the pitch. They're like, it's a bit like the, you know, that Escobar goal where they all fall and look like they've been shot. It's just awful to see that for the third time and right at the death. And it's, of course, one of the most famous goals in Peñarol's history, you know, to win the game right at the death. And Diego Aguirre obviously became a club legend. And the Nacional equivalent of that, not quite as glamorous, is called the La Toma de Porto Alegre, the taking of Porto Alegre, where Nacional beat Internacional, a kind of the triumph of nation over internationalism, to win the 1980 Copa Libertadores. They go to Porto Alegre, one of the harder places to go in Brazil, and Valdemar Victorino scores the crucial goal that brings, you know, Nacional the Copa Libertadores game home. And again, that's one of those games that every single Nacional fan of a certain age says that they went. I think something like 30,000 fans travelled across to Porto Alegre to watch that one. So there's a couple of the biggest games in the club's histories.
I absolutely love this feature. I absolutely love it. While you were chatting there, Pete, I was looking at the old film, The Arsenal Stadium Mystery, and I feel like the game that you talked about is some sort of L-stream, Ealing comedy type subterfuge based around a game of football, especially with the briefcase involved in it. Yeah, it's great. It's a great story. Clearly, everything about this episode from start to finish has just been bigger than every other one in terms of football clubs, number of games you were allowed to talk about, goals in games, everything is just bigger. So the sort of last section that we look at are famous players and managers. And I assume here we are also going to be bigger and better than most cities that we've looked at. I guess you will all have players that you'll have picked out. You'll all certainly, I hope, will have your favourites. Pete, we'll start with you with regards to the general groundwork of famous players and managers that have either played or started in Montevideo or are associated with Montevideo. You know, they may well have moved on, but certainly where the city has had a major influence on their career.
Yeah, and I think pretty much every player that we know that, you know, was in the 1930s, 1950 World Cup, or, you know, has become famous since, has got a link to one of the big Uruguayan club. So let's start with a couple of the smaller clubs and maybe some of the historic figures that people maybe don't know. And maybe Stevie and Gary can pick up the most famous ones possibly of later generations. But Bella Vista, a club we haven't talked about a huge amount. They had three huge players in a really massive era where Uruguay put themselves on the map. José Nassassi, I've mentioned him a couple of times. He did move from Bella Vista to Nacional. But he was known as the Marshal, El Mariscal, was a captain in the 1920s of the Olympics winning teams, won the World Cup in 1930. The Bella Vista Stadium is named after him. And it wasn't just him. José Leandro Andrade, one of the first great black players of the continent, let alone of Uruguay, and certainly in a nation that prided itself or really looked to be as white as possible. He completely smashed through the colour barrier in the 1920s. He became a phenomenon of the 1924 Olympics in particular in Europe and 1928 as well. And then Pablo Dorado was another player of that 1930 World Cup. Again, going back to some of the players of that particular era of Peñarol, we have people like of the great 1950. We look at the 1950s team. They had Oscar Miguez, who scored five goals in that particular tournament when they beat Brazil in the Maracanazo in 1950, scored 103 goals for Peñarol. And actually, as a person, I think that's still true. He scored the most goals for Uruguayan World Cups with eight in total. Obdulio Varela was one of the great other Varela. There's a great Uruguayan president called Varela. Obdulio Varela was the captain of the 1950 team. Again, a hero of the nation, a hero of Peñarol. Juan Schiaffino, again, another hero of that particular 1950 team, was again at Peñarol, as were seven other players in that squad, including Alcides Gigia, who scored the final goal. In terms of Nacional, again, the book by Martin de Cruz is brilliant on some of these early players. We'll pick out a couple. We'll pick out the Cespedes brothers, Amilcar, Bolívar and Carlos, who were some of the first great members of the Nacional team who, you know, competed against Peñarol and competed against Albion and created a reputation for Nacional as a club. And they also have this particular sadness about them because Bolívar and Carlos both died in a smallpox outbreak at the start of the century. And was probably Bolívar was one of the first great young footballers to die in that particular nation. So he became, you know, almost like a martyr, you know, a very early, you know, Duncan Edwards kind of figure, if you like. A similar tragic story is the story of Abdon Porte, who again was a midfielder who was champion of South America with the Uruguayan side in 1917, but 1918, realizing that his place in the Peñarol in the Nacional side wasn't secure, after a particular game against a team called Charlie, I think, bizarrely, went into the pitch after the game in the kind of dark, went to the center circle and shot himself in the head, and became this kind of tragic figure of, you know, a person who wasn't prepared to leave the club, wasn't prepared to, you know, not be good enough anymore. And he was only 25. So again, that story of Abdon Porte has gone down in history. It actually inspired a short story by Horacio Quiroga. And again, we could look at some of the other great players of the 1930s, like Hector Scarone, known as the Wizard, who won 21 titles and scored 300 odd goals for the club. Hector Castro, the one-armed who lost his arm with a, you know, when he was using electric saw. Again, the hero of the 9 versus 11 derby, legend of that particular era.
Just jump in there, it puts a whole new concept on the phrase the stray elbow for that one.
yeah, I don't think he carried it loud with him, but yeah. But I mean, yeah, there are so many great players from that particular, you know, early era that, you know, are legends of those particular clubs. So there are the kind of the historic figures. I'm sure the guys will talk about some of the newer ones.
Excellent. You've talked about all the ones I was going to chat about, Pete, but that's right. I'll let you off. Don't worry about it. Gary, we'll come to you next. Players, managers that you associate or that you sort of think are worthy of mention.
Yeah, well, I listed three players and Pete's covered them all. but I'll just add a little bit of background in there. Schiaffino, actually, he played in the World Cup in 1954 as well as 1950. After the World Cup, he got transferred to Milan, and he was the most expensive player in football history at the time. 52 million lira, what that converts to now is probably top slightly, but I mean, he was transferred to Serie A and has become the most expensive footballer. He also managed the club briefly in the 70s. Alcides Gigia, as Pete mentioned, scored the winning goal in 1950 World Cup final. But it wasn't a World Cup final as such because he played on a league group sort of thing. But in effect, it was the final because Brazil just needed a draw to get the trophy. And obviously, the other guy, Peñarol, we can't talk about Peñarol without mentioning the great, the wonderful Alberto Spencer. Kept scoring a couple of Libertadores, 48 goals, I say, more than even Pele. A couple of coaches of Peñarol, Juan Hoberg, who was coached there in 1971. He coached the Uruguay national team at the World Cup in 1970 that Brazil beat in the semi-final. If I called him pragmatic, that would be a compliment and a sort of underplaying his approach. The other sort of well-known or sort of celebrated coach I was going to mention, he was briefly there in 1962, was Bela Gutman, who actually won the European Cup with Benfica. I think won it a couple of times, and he's the guy who also cursed Benfica after they refused to give a pay rise after they won the 1962 European Cup, and cursed that they would never win a European trophy for the next 100 years without him, and they haven't. They haven't. I mean, we're 100 years gone yet, but it's we're over halfway, and they have. Benfica have never won a European trophy since. Peter also mentioned Abdulio Barella, and he was caretaker manager in 1955, very briefly, alongside the goalkeeper from 1950 World Cup, Roque Maspoli. A couple of coaches at Nacional, Alfio Basia, obviously, who coached Argentina World Cup, and Xavier Moreira, who coached Brazil in the 1954 World Cup as well. So, yeah, there's a few famous names being there.
I feel like we're going through the ages here, Stephen. That there's a whole heap of pressure now for you to take us to take us from the early days of the European Cup into relatively contemporary times.
Oh, I mean, there's tons. I mean, that's the thing. It's like shooting fish in a barrel as far as kind of like, you know, Montevideo and Uruguay are concerned. I mean, how can we have this conversation without throwing in Enzo Francescoli?
There he is. Well done, Stephen. Love that.
Who did everything that he did without even touching Peñarol or Nacional. You know, he came from Wanderers before going off on his odyssey around kind of like the rest of South America and Europe and, you know, everything else he did. Slightly more esoteric, Nestor Goncalves, who was the rock of the midfielder for Peñarol amongst those three victories in the 1960s in the Copa Libertadores, defensive midfielder of massive repute. You know, coaches, Oscar Tabarez, you know, where else can you go? He won a Libertadores in 87. He won the Copa America in 2011. You know, did it on, you know, at the highest levels in both, you know, the national game, the international game, and the club game, you know, with the Uruguay national team and with Peñarol, you know, absolutely spectacular. Roberto Scaroni, who was the, you know, the Helenio Herrera of his generation, really, as far as Uruguayan football is concerned. He was the man that led Peñarol to the first two Copa Libertadores. He even went on and took the Peruvians Universitario onto the 72 Copa Libertadores final. You know, we're talking of a nation here that has no shortage of gods, whether that's kind of like on the touchline or with the ball at the feet.
I'm going to just give Danubio a mention. We haven't brought them up, but, you know, we talked about them earlier being known as the University of Uruguayan football. That's their nickname. And here's some of the names that Danubio produced as a club. We've got Alvaro Recoba, one of the great kind of dead ball specialists, you know, of his particular generation. We've got Ruben Sosa, again, known as the Prince. Probably didn't get as much credit as he really earned, but had a fantastic career in Lazio, Inter Milan, Dortmund. You know, again, big Nacional fan eventually, but, you know, but was a Danubio player first and foremost. You've got Edinson Cavani, again, Danubio player. Diego Forlan had a brief period at Peñarol, but really made his name at Danubio. And for Middlesbrough fans, Christian Stuani. So again, Danubio really do deserve that name of the university. And one final name to mention, it, since we brought up Pelé, the famous kind of dummy that he made against the Uruguayan goalkeeper. That particular Uruguayan goalkeeper, Ladislav Mazurkovic, was a Racing player. And again, was probably still recognised as probably one of the best goalkeepers in the continent. You know, I think that he is only known really in Europe for that particular moment. In South America, Mazurkovic is right up there in terms of great goalkeepers. And again, you know, he was a Racing player. So, you know, it's a lot of these, you know, world famous names have made their names at some of the smaller clubs before going on to probably bigger things.
I can't believe none of you have brought up Montero, who is the archetypal Uruguayan defender, if ever there was one. Clearly not my type of player. However, there is a a quiet, begrudging, behind closed doors and behind the curtains admiration for a player who is the most sent off in Serie A history. I've got a lot of time for that. Guys, last thing that we need to do, how are you going to pick this? I have no idea. Gary, you can only go and watch one team. I'm not having you watching seven just because you can. There is literally one season ticket up for grabs and that's it. So if you happen to spend a year, although you probably couldn't even if you went every week, you probably couldn't see all the games and all the teams playing a year. But if we drop you into, like we do at the end of this, if we drop you into Montevideo and you have all of this that we've talked about to choose from, where are you going to watch your football? Stephen, well, I'll let you go first on this one this time.
After everything that Pete's just said has fully endorsed my choice, Danubio. You know, they even wear a sash.
Oh, nailed on.
Hooray! Nailed on. Excellent. So is it based, was your choice based purely on sash, or was it also the added information that's been given?
Oh, the added information that's been given. Well, I mean, the thing is, I read into them and saw the prolific nature of what they're almost kind of like a traditional old style West Ham in a way, in that kind of academy type of way. You know, I think if I'd been stuck in London, you know, as a kid, I'd have been going to a West Ham or a QPR or something like that. And I think Danubio, we can kind of like bill in that kind of, you know, almost in that kind of category. They've been this great, you know, I don't know, just kind of like this environment for talent to just spring forth. You know, you know there with that list of players that they've produced that you're just going to be entertained. They might not always win stuff. You know, they're going to fall short clearly, but they're going to do it in style. You know, in the style on the pitch with what they're doing, kicking the ball around, and in style with the kit that they're wearing.
Love that. What a ringing endorsement. Pete, we'll come to you next. Where are you watching your football in Montevideo? Or who are you watching, sorry?
Yeah, no, it's desperately difficult. I mean, if El Tanque Sisley had not really gone down to the amateur leagues a few years ago and was still in the top league, then I would be straight along to watch the Sisley tank. You know, I think, and I'd be wearing army gear just to get into the, you know, the kind of thing. You know, I mean, I think you've got to go to a first division club here. I think you've got to. I was tempted by Danubio. I do remember my first Panini sticker album for the 86 World Cup having quite a few Danubio players and quite liking the name without knowing why. You know, it's just one of those names you quite like. But I think I'm going to go to Montevideo Wanderers. I think there's a kind of a link with history. You know, they're one of the original, or one of the close to be original teams. It's there and thereabouts. They've won it once. Francis Scully was a player there. He might come back and have a kick about. So I think I'm going along to watch Montevideo Wanderers. But, you know, I'm secretly selling my season ticket each week and probably going and watching pretty much every other game in the country, in the city, you know, just because I want to see what they're like. So, but yeah, I'll head along to Montevideo Wanderers.
Brilliant. Love that. And Gary, remember, one team. You're not ground hopping around Montevideo.
Well, you say one team, but it's two teams. The reason why. You'll see what I say, because I want to see the big derby game. So I'm going to go to one of the big clubs you've got to see the big derby game in Montevideo. So, you know, that's where I'm going. And I did look at Nacional, and, you know, they've got three Copa Libertadores. Every time they won the Copa Libertadores, they won the Intercontinental Cup the same year as well, which is interesting. And one distinction they've got is their fans had, in 2013, the Copa Libertadores game against Deportivo Toluca, they had the world's biggest flag ever unfurled at a football match, which apparently cost something in the region of $50,000. And the money was raised by the fans and their player to place called Parque Central. And the La Banda de Parque Central, the fans there raised the money to buy the. So I was thinking about that, but I think I'm going to go. I'm going to end up at Peñarol, if only because, you know, Alberto Spencer played there, and I want to sort of, you're going to pay homage to the great man himself. And I'll say, so I'm going to Peñarol, not for a glory hunter, just to say the big derby game.
Do you know that Nacional only made that flag because the record before that was held by Peñarol for the world's biggest flag?
Yeah.
10-year-old flag. I forgot to mention it. Their flag was 309 meters by 47 meters. And again, in the video of Manias, you see them making it coming out. So, yeah, Nacional basically, you know, doubled it. You know, they went for the big, big move and doubled it. There was a longer one. Millonarios created one that was something like 750 meters long and 40 meters wide. And then River Plate in Argentina have had a flag that was like 7,829 meters and 87 centimeters long, and only 4.5 meters wide. So they basically made this long flag that went all the way along a particular avenue in Buenos Aires. But yeah, even in flags, there is this ridiculous rivalry between the clubs. Yeah.
I have a lot of time for that level of pettiness amongst two absolute global footballing superpowers. It comes down to the fact of who's got a bigger flag. I have a lot of time for that. Guys, what a brilliant... Well, I think it's been a brilliant episode. Clearly, the listeners will decide, and the Portsmouth and Liverpool fans won't think it's a brilliant episode, but I think it's been brilliant. I think it's been my favourite one so far from the first leg and the second leg. Pete, incredible knowledge, considering how much information needed to be retained, learned, wherever it is that you get it from. But it's been everything that I wanted it to be and more.
No, it's just it's a great footballing city. It's somewhere I desperately want to go. I've got a commitment from a kind of fellow academic friend of mine called Andres Morales living over there in Uruguay to have me over next time I get the chance. So I'm desperately going to take him up on that as soon as I can. But yeah, it's a great city. I'd love to go there. And it's, again, a proper football place.
Stephen, enjoyed it?
Oh, joy is always absolutely spectacular. And you're right, this is out of a list of absolutely fantastic episodes. And this has definitely been the best one.
And finally, Gary, first of all, you know, hopefully you've enjoyed the episode, but also it's always up to you for the, well, I'll say the big reveal. You just leave clues. And I'm supposed to know where we are next week, and I never do. So first of all, have you enjoyed it? And then second of all, a little clue as to where we're going next week.
Yeah, it's been absolutely classic. And I think as the guys have both said, you know, this has probably been the most enjoyable, and certainly for me. I mean, we learn everything. We learn so much every episode from Pete. But this has been like, I don't know, like a university education rather than school day. So it'd be great. Yeah. So next time, we travel 2,000 miles to get to Montevideo. So this next one is a little hop, step, and a jump. It's only 440 miles. We're moving. We're going to the Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul, which is the most southern state of Brazil. Just an interesting little factoid that I learned when I was doing a bit of research today, that the distance between the southern tip of Brazil and the northern tip of Brazil is larger than the distance between Brazil and Canada. That's how big Brazil is. That's an interesting little factoid, isn't it? Anyway, there we go. You know, the city we're going to has been mentioned earlier by Pete in one of the sort of games he was discussing, and it translates from Portuguese as the joyful harbour. So we should be having some fun there. The home of a famous club there who go under the nickname of the Immortal Tricolour.
Wow. There's plenty of clues there for anybody who has more knowledge than me. And just to put you on the spot, Gary, which airport in Montevideo are we heading back to before we take this flight?
Just hang on a second. It's here somewhere.
You've got to memorise it, Gary.
It's one of the best known. One of the parts we did, was it on the last time or the time before? One of the clubs was named after an airport. And I remember mentioning, say, you know, perhaps somebody should call them, you know, Heathrow FC. And they didn't. And I'm just filling a bit of time. I've got it. Okay. So the airport is actually called, interestingly, it has actually been described by a travel organisation as one of the most efficient and traveller-friendly airports in South America. And it's called the Aeropuerto Internacional de Carrasco General Severio Lebaroso.
I mean, organisation is not a strong characteristic of Latin American airports. I'm going to tell you that now. So it's not doing that. It's not that big a deal.
I'm going to say most people just don't go because they can't say it. They just go to a different one.
Imagine printing that on your travel documents. Let me know.
Oh, I love that. Guys, like I said, it's been brilliant. Thank you. I have had the best time. Thank you so much. I've absolutely loved it. All that's left for me to say is thank you again to the guys. Thank you for listening. And please join us again for part four, second leg, where we're going to where Gary gave us the clues to. I will find out before we start next week. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.